I'm very happy now to welcome Madeline Miller. She's author of the award-winning novel, The Song of Achilles, and she will be giving a talk tonight called Excavating Achilles, Following Homer's Hero Through the Ages. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's so wonderful to be here.
It's great to have you here. Now, this is a novel about Achilles, told from the point of view of his beloved friend and companion, Patroclus. How did you come to write this, and particularly to focus on Patroclus?
Well, the story of Achilles had really been with me since childhood. My mother used to read the stories of the Iliad and the Greek myths to me as bedtime stories. So ever since then, I was just completely hooked on Achilles' story. There was something about it that I was really drawn to. I think some of it had to do with his youth and kind of the tragedy of his story. But as I continued to study it, I was really drawn into this other, more minor character whose name was Patroclus, that in the Iliad is named the most beloved companion of Achilles. But he's both completely central to Homer's poem, The Iliad, and also a very minor character. And so it's kind of the mystery that drew me to him originally, that he is the center of Achilles' life, but he gets very little stage time. And so I started to kind of wonder, well, who is this Patroclus? Why does he mean so much to Achilles? What was their relationship like before they got here to Troy? And that was really what led me to write the novel, is I sort of thought, well, Homer tells us the end of the story, but what's the beginning?
Right. And so what from the original sources, from the epics, I mean, obviously we're not talking about history, we're talking about poetry, but still, what do we know about Patroclus? Like, what's the starting point?
So Homer gives us a couple hints. He tells us that when Patroclus was a boy, he was born a prince, as Achilles was. Pretty much all the major heroes who go to Troy, Ajax, Agamemnon, they're all kings or princes in their own right. He was also born a prince, but when he was a child, he accidentally kills another boy in this sort of disastrous circumstance. He's exiled from his kingdom and, you know, ejected, loses his princehood, and he's taken in by Achilles, and Achilles' father is sort of a charity case, and that's how the two boys become friends. So I was intrigued by that, not only the trauma of his story, but also the fact that he comes to Achilles really hoping that you know, with nothing, and kind of as an outcast. And then the two end up growing up together. So there's that. There was also the fact that he is the only hero who's called gentle in the Iliad, which, if you know anything about the Greek mythology, gentleness is not a common quality among Greek heroes. So that definitely caught my attention. There's a beautiful eulogy that's delivered for Patroclus, where one of the other characters says that he was always gentle. And so that really stuck with me. You know, here we have Achilles, the most ferocious warrior of the Greeks, who just tears through the Trojan ranks whenever he wants to, and his most beloved companion is this this person who is called gentle. So that was very interesting. And then, of course, the intense grief that Achilles experiences when he loses Patroclus. Just, you know, what Patroclus must mean to him. There must be an intense relationship there, kind of like an iceberg. We just see the little bit, but there's this whole backstory to them. And that's pretty much all we know. We know that he knows a little bit of medicine, as Achilles does. Very valuable for warriors to also know medicine. And Achilles had been trained by the great centaur healer, Chiron, and had passed that information onto Patroclus. So that's sort of the end of what we know.
And so that is a way that you can enter and kind of make it your own. Because, I mean, here you are, in the shadows of these, you know, epics that are considered some of the greatest literature of all time, and then the many retellings over the years, and then you wake up one day and say, I'm going to write my own novel based on these epics. I mean, that's a kind of a courageous and gutsy thing to do.
Well, I saw with Patroclus, I felt like there was sort of a gap in the story. And so I felt like, you know, there was a little bit of room there. But it was, I was initially very, very nervous about starting the story. You sort of are afraid that I didn't want to tell my professors what I was working on. I was a little worried that maybe the classics police would come to my house and take me away, that I was doing this. But It was really incredible. I mean, one thing about Homer's world is that I think because this poetry was originally oral poetry, the world is incredibly expansive. There's just so much room in Homer's world. There's so many characters, there's so much space, and I think it's why so many authors over the years have come to Homer and sort of written back to him, written their own version, found their own corner of Homer. It's because he has such a rich and large and welcoming world.
And to do that as a woman, I mean, you're not the first. You've been compared to Mary Renault, who's written, you know, these now classics also, but there is, being female, a kind of different take on war and conflict, almost just by necessity.
It's been interesting to be a woman and coming to this, but I think there's also kind of that I never sort of saw it as that I might have a different perspective. I sort of saw it as I love this material and I wanted to throw myself in it. So I wasn't kind of coming, I want to represent this perspective or that perspective, just that I wanted to do justice to the stories that I loved.
We're talking to Madeline Miller, author of The Song of Achilles. So when you are working with source material that is basically an epic, is poetry, is mythology, is only possibly based on historical fact. I mean, that's another whole conversation of whatever reality there might have been of the Trojan Wars and all of that. But you still have to follow certain outlines and outcomes because that's how the story went. So you also, within that, have to find a lot of room for imagination and invention. And as you say, there's a lot of space in that for you to kind of navigate.
Yes. I really, so because Patroclus was so little known, but Achilles is so well known, I was kind of sewing Patroclus into Achilles' legends, and I was able to imagine that. But there were way too many legends about Achilles for me to use them all. So I was also choosing which ones I was going to use. And certainly I made changes from kind of some of the traditional stories, even from the Iliad, although the Homer and his poem was my primary source. One of the most major changes I made, or at least in my opinion, one of the most major, was the fact that the slave woman who is given to Achilles and becomes kind of the point of contention that starts off the Iliad, her name is Briseis. And in the original Iliad, she's actually a princess. And I was really drawn to the fact that there are all these people who live around the area of Troy that the Greeks have been raiding for 10 years. They have nothing whatsoever to do with this war. They're farmers, they're, you know, innocent tradesmen, and they are just, their homes are burned. They're, you know, being slaughtered and taken captive. And I really wanted that voice to be there. I thought, you know, we have enough aristocrats in this story. Let's have some people who are, you know, being affected by this war who are not princes. And so I chose to make her a farmer's daughter as opposed to a princess. And that was really important for me because I really wanted that voice in the story.
Yeah, I mean, that's, these stories allow us to think about some of the kind of basic conflicts that we're always living with, which is that great cultures, quote-unquote great cultures, are often really, really mean.
Mm, yes, yes. And, you know, even all the sort of, we're with Achilles in the Iliad as he has this horrible rift with Agamemnon, and Agamemnon and Achilles are both incredibly proud and no one wants to back down, but the people who get put through the meat grinder are the common soldiers who are there because they've been called there by their commanders and have no say whatsoever in this argument that's going on, but they're the ones who are dying.
Right, and like all great work, it allows you to reflect on your own time.
Yes, of course.
So this is also a homoerotic love story complete with panting and touching and all these things between Achilles and Patroclus. And it definitely makes one think about sexuality and how homosexuality is constructed now, how it was constructed then. I mean, mm-hmm. I sort of always had the sense of there was a kind of camaraderie and fun in the male-to-male relationships in ancient Greece, and the male-female, you know, wife and children was more sort of like duty and family, mm-hmm. but not the sense of a kind of like romance, like my first love kind of thing, the way we have now, which is so rampant in our culture. And what was your process of like understanding that and writing that whole theme of their love?
Mm. Well, as I was approaching their relationship, I was really trying to, as you say, kind of reconstruct what ideas about same-sex relationships would have been like. And it really varied very much in the ancient world, depending on where you were and when you were. And kind of the classic is Athens, you know, 5th century Athens, where you have the older man and the younger man, and the older man is established, and he's a citizen, and he takes part in the government, and he's been to war, and the younger man is kind of just entering, you know, his role in the government, and the older man kind of serves as a mentor, and it's also a romantic relationship. That's kind of the classic construction. But there were many, many, many others as well. And so what I was really interested in is the fact that as a man in the ancient world, you were supposed to duty, as you say, have a wife, produce an heir, you know, and generally your wife was supposed to be part of an alliance you would make on your family's behalf, that sort of thing. And that was very much about duty. But same-sex relationships were where the romance could come in. And there's tons of lyric poetry that we have written by men to beautiful men that they are, you know, in love with, just the same as there's lyric poetry by men written to women. Or in Sappho's case, women written to women. So that romantic aspect is absolutely there in the ancient world. And in fact, I mean, this is where kind of misogyny comes into the classical world. But it was often seen that you could only ever have a full, complete romantic relationship with a man if you were a man, because women weren't your equal. So only a man could be your intellectual equal, and you could kind of have a full relationship with him. Of course, we have rejected that today, thank goodness. But that was kind of where they were coming from in the ancient world.
Which puts a really different interpretation on what we might today call sexual orientation.
Hmm. Yes, I mean, I think, you know, sexual mores have changed. You know, in the ancient world, it was much more common to have a lover. For example, there's a quote in the great Roman gossip Suetonius. It's talking about the kind of sexual proclivities of the Julio-Claudian emperors. He talks about the Emperor Claudius, and he says, here's the thing about Claudius, he only liked women. So, you know, that was sort of considered, oh, that's unusual. To only like women was as unusual as to, you know, only maybe choose to be with same sex. So it was a different world, and it was really looked at differently. Kind of the classic example is Alexander the Great, who had a lover, and also wives as well, multiple wives. And he and his lover actually modeled themselves on Achilles and Patroclus. That,
right.
That Alexander the Great went to Achilles' tomb, made sacrifice, and said, you know, with his usual modesty, I'm the next Achilles. And his lover Hephaestion made sacrifice to Patroclus and said, you know, I'm the next Patroclus.
Which, again, I mean, when you think about the way in which we talk about homosexuality, bisexuality, and all those things now, it's as if there's a kind of thing that you're born with, and only 4% of the population is quote-unquote homosexual. And this is just like a whole different, I mean, it paints a picture of a kind of fluidity that we don't really embrace.
Yes, and I think that we're sort of moving in that direction, but far from kind of the fluidity, as you said.
And it has a lot to say about power dynamics too. I mean, we're not talking about, well, in the way you write it, we kind of, in some ways, are, but talking about equals coming together, because there was a kind of mutual love between Achilles and Patroclus that, at least at the beginning, didn't seem, I mean, Achilles is certainly the dominant person, the dominant warrior, he's the son of a goddess, and so on, and Patroclus is a really humble guy, but in your version, they're the same age, and they come together in this mutual love, whereas my one sense of the ancient world is more like what you're talking about with, you know, the elder statesman and the younger guy just coming in, and almost never or rarely true equality.
Well, and that's actually one of the things that I found extraordinary about the interactions that Achilles and Patroclus have in the Iliad, is that they approach each other as total equals, the way they speak to each other. That when Patroclus goes to Achilles and says, Achilles, you got to let go of your anger, you have to fight, you know, you have to save the Greeks, he doesn't speak to him as someone who's afraid, where Achilles has all the power, and he sort of throws himself on his knees before Achilles, but he also speaks to him very bracingly, and as an emotional equal, and their scenes together are incredibly domestic. They're clearly partners. And so I was really drawn to that. And it's interesting to look at how the kind of classic 5th century Athens writers interpreted their relationship, because they were constantly trying to fit the Achilles and Patroclus of the Iliad into that kind of the older man with the power and the younger man with the beauty. And the truth is that they couldn't do it. They would sort of say, well, Achilles has to be the older one because he's powerful. He's the more powerful one. But then they would say, oh, no, but Achilles is the most beautiful one, so he has to be the younger one. And of course, what they're doing is they're sort of imposing their ideas onto, you know, a text that was written many years before and about a time that was many, many years before.
Very interesting. So you, of course, are familiar with the millennia of commentary on the Iliad.
Yes. I mean, that was something that I really looked at. Actually, at some point, before I even thought I was going to write this novel, I had considered writing my thesis on kind of Achilles through the ages. And so I had done a lot of research into how Achilles has been interpreted and how his stories have been told and retold over the years. And I was most actually inspired by Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida, which is his play about the Iliad that has some very interesting scenes with Achilles and Patroclus.
We're talking to Madeline Miller about her book, Song of Achilles. Now, you also worked in theater. You directed Shakespeare.
I did.
How did that influence, if it did, the writing of this novel?
Very much so. In fact, it was my very first production that I ever directed was Troilus and Cressida. And it was so intellectually thrilling for me to get to interact with these characters in a way that wasn't just academic, but also kind of creative at the same time. That, you know, I had been approaching them from a scholarly perspective. I'd been writing papers about them. I'd been doing research. But here, as a director, my job was to tell Achilles what his motivation was and, you know, help design Agamemnon's costume and choreograph the sword fight between Achilles and Hector. And it was so exciting to get to enter into that world from the creative perspective that when the play was finished, I basically didn't want to stop. And it was right after I directed that play that I opened my laptop and started writing Patroclus' story.
Wow. So how long, what happened from there? How long did it take? What was the process like?
So it actually took 10 years, the same length as the Trojan War. So that was not planned. During that time, I was working full-time as a teacher, teaching Latin and Greek. I was directing Shakespeare plays, and then kind of on the weekends and in vacations, I was writing this book kind of as much as I could. So that's why I think partially why it took so long. And theater was very helpful to me there, too, because there is sort of no better boot camp for learning how to tell a story than directing a play. And, of course, working with a playwright like Shakespeare, which is primarily the plays I was directing, is also, you know, you learn so much about storytelling and pacing and characterization. So I feel like that was also incredibly helpful, although I didn't plan it that way. I feel like that it was very useful to be doing that at the same time.
It's kind of a shame that I've had a number of fiction writers on the air over the years who have been academics and then became fiction writers, and there seems to be a real gap between academic thinking and creative thinking. There shouldn't be quite so much as there is, it seems to me.
I agree, and I think that for me it was, you know, whenever I would get kind of stuck in the story, I would go and read scholarship, and, you know, I would go back to the original, but I would also go read, you know, essays and people talking about it, and there was something about that that stimulated my creative mind. And, you know, engaging with it creatively also made me want to go back to the research. So I agree. I feel like that there can be a lot more flow back and forth there.
When you come in contact with academics who are real scholars, do they respect the kind of thing that you are doing? In other words, there's sometimes you have this, you know, somebody writes a popular book and then they're kind of ostracized by their former academic colleagues.
For the most part, there have been a few exceptions, but for the most part, the classics community has actually been incredibly welcoming and lovely about the book. I think, you know, we all want the same thing. We all want to share these stories and bring them to light. And so I feel very grateful. I mean, my mentors who mentored me as a scholar have been incredibly wonderful about the book coming out. And I got reviewed in the Bryn Mawr Classical Journal, which is, you know, a really important classical journal. And so it has been mostly a really wonderful experience.
Do you see this book as a kind of, what would you say, doorway to the classics for those who've never read Homer and aren't about to really start necessarily?
Absolutely. I when I wrote this book, I really wanted it to be able to be read both by people who already love the stories and to sort of have goodies in there for them, for people who knew the Iliad very well. But I also really wanted it to be the type of thing where you didn't have to know any background on the story to be able to pick it up, that it could be an introduction. And you know, when we think about Homer and the Iliad nowadays, I think we often think of them as something that's very elevated, possibly elitist, maybe fusty, boring. But the truth is that the Iliad and the Odyssey were the common cultural currency in the ancient world. Everyone knew these stories. Everyone loved them. They weren't just for one group of people. They really were for everyone because they sort of spoke to universal human experience. And so in writing this book, I really wanted to honor that tradition. I wanted this to be a book that was for everyone.
And so how has it been received? I mean, you've won some major prizes, and the book, I think, has sold quite well.
It has been very exciting to have readers respond to it, and to, you know, having spent 10 years alone in my head with these characters, it is really amazing to see them reaching so many readers, you know, around the world, not only in the U.S. So far the reception has been just amazing. I'm very grateful.
So talk once again about some of the influences on you. I mean, Mary Bruneau is a writer to whom you've been compared, but I mean, in terms of novel writing, it was one thing to go back to the Iliad and the commentators on the Iliad from the 5th century or whatever, but contemporary or, you know, the last few centuries novels.
I love Margaret Atwood. She's one of my favorite authors. I read her, reading her work, particularly The Handmaid's Tale, when I was a teenager, made me want to be a writer. I love Laurie Moore. I think she's an incredible, incredible author. More recently, I read their work after I finished my book, so I can't really claim that they were an inspiration, but I love David Mitchell, who wrote Cloud Atlas. The movie just came out, but he's written many, many things that are all terrific. Hilary Mantel, who just won her second Booker Award for Bring Up the Bodies, her kind of the story of Henry VIII's reign and kind of the switch over to, you know, the Anglican Church. I feel like there's so many authors that went into this. As a child, I was really just a voracious, voracious reader. And so I felt like all those authors were kind of with me. one of my favorite books as a child that actually, again, inspired me to want to be a writer was Watership Down.
Ah, yes.
Yes. It, truly an epic story, and I loved it as a child, and rereading it as an adult, you realize that, gosh, he's really writing in the epic tradition. You know, this is pretty much the Iliad and the Odyssey, but with rabbits. So it's interesting to see the way people can play with the epic tradition in lots of different ways.
Well, and it's interesting because what you're doing in a lot of ways is so personal and kind of intimate as a story, and yet it's also within the tradition of this epic.
Yeah. So, and I owe very much to Virgil's Aeneid. Virgil himself was writing back to the Iliad and the Odyssey. He was sort of trying to write the Roman version of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And so his poem is kind of the first in a long line of writing back to Homer. And so that was also an influence. The character of Achilles' son, who shows up towards the end of the book, is very much my homage to Virgil's portrait of the same character.
How did you find the tone? Was it a process of finding that particular tone in which you wrote this novel?
It was. That was actually the other part of the 10-year process. That about halfway through, I had a completed draft of the book, and I ended up throwing it out and starting over from scratch.
Really?
I did.
Actually, that's a pretty common story. In the old days, they would throw it in the incinerator of their building.
Right. I didn't do that. I junked it on my computer. But what I decided is that up until that point, I actually felt like I'd been too influenced by the epic tradition, and that in the ancient epic tradition, there's a diction that goes along with writing in the epic mode, sort of a very formal, kind of high-flown, you know, swift-footed Achilles and the wine-dark sea and rosy-fingered dawn that goes along with writing in the epic mode. And I think I had been too influenced by that. And what I sort of realized about halfway in is that Patroclus is a character. You know, he's my narrator. He himself isn't an epic person. That he is... He gets dragged into the world of epic, of, you know, destiny and gods and war because he loves Achilles. But that's not actually where he would naturally go. And so I really needed to find a different voice for Patroclus. And the voice I found eventually was the voice of lyric poetry, which is the poetry of friendship and love and sort of daily life. And that was really where I wanted Patroclus to be speaking from. So in an epic story, but speaking with a lyric voice.
And so, I mean, you really just started from scratch. Did you refer to the old book at all?
I referred to it, but I sort of basically realized that I needed to rewrite it. At first, I kind of was like, well, maybe I just need to rewrite the first chapter. And then I rewrote the first chapter, and I thought, well, now I need to rewrite the second chapter so that it met. And then I needed to... So I kind of went through it that way, kind of deluding myself that every time I rewrote a section, that would be the end of what I needed to rewrite.
Right.
But eventually, it became clear that I just needed to rewrite the whole thing, which when you have 500 pages that you've worked on is sort of a moment of reckoning. But... It was absolutely clear to me that that's what I needed to do to really represent the Patroclus that I wanted. So that helped me push through.
It seemed like it must have also been, I mean, it must have been really fun in a lot of ways to write centaurs and goddesses and just make them the way you want them to be or the way you feel them.
It was. It absolutely was. I mean, you know, when I think you're approaching these ancient stories... you kind of come to this fork in the road, which is, are you going to include the fantastical elements or not? And there's kind of two ways to go. You can go the route where it isn't really Poseidon who's making the earth shake. You know, it's an earthquake, but everyone thinks it's Poseidon. Or you can have it really be Poseidon. And so I thought, you know, there was kind of that another moment of reckoning early on where I thought, am I really going to write a centaur? And I thought, yes, I am. I love the fantastical elements of the story, and they're completely central to Homer's poem. That the gods come in and go out of Homer's poem. They are part of the you know, base foundation of it. So I wanted to keep them in this version. And it was fun to imagine the gods and Thetis in particular, Achilles' terrifying sea nymph mother. That the gods were terrifying. They were alien, they were incredibly irrational, usually, and they were, you know, not all powerful in her case, because she's a sea nymph. She's not, you know, one of the highest gods, but very powerful. And so bringing that sort of terror was something I enjoyed.
Yeah, poor little Patroclus has to... It's like, my mother wants to see you. Yeah. Oh, no.
Exactly.
So what's next for you? Are you going down an academic path, or are you going to write more novels?
I absolutely want to write another novel, and I also want to return to teaching. I miss teaching very much. Being in the classroom and in dialogue with students is always, I think, incredibly intellectually exciting and creatively exciting. And I love working with students in that way. In terms of a novel, I am working on a couple different things, one classical, one not. So I'm sort of just in the early blundering phases about that, but seeing where they're going.
Can you give us a hint what millennium it's set in?
Sure. So the classical one is about Odysseus, actually. He was one of my favorite characters to write, and so I'm looking forward to returning to his story and finishing that up. And the other thing I'm working on is actually based on a Shakespeare play. so.
Ah, okay. Well, Madeline Miller is author of the award-winning novel The Song of Achilles, and tonight she will be giving a talk called Excavating Achilles, Following Homer's Hero Through the Ages. It's at the New Mexico History Museum at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. And ladies and gentlemen, if you go over there, be sure to use the Washington Avenue entrance, which is across the street from the public library. Madeline, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Megan Burns. She's Associate Director of Santa Fe Performing Arts, and she's co-director of The Wizard of Oz, which is happening this weekend and next weekend, the last two weekends of April. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
And we have with us Sophia Avery Kapulski, who is playing Dorothy, and Leo O'Connell, the Tin Man. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi.
So let's talk for a moment about The Wizard of Oz. I mean, doing The Wizard of Oz on stage after the 1939 movie, which was one of the greatest works of art of all time, according to everybody, how do you follow in those footsteps?
Oh my gosh, how do we follow in those footsteps? Well, we definitely do our best. We definitely are making it our own. We're making it work for our stage and with our cast. But luckily, we have an incredibly talented cast.
Aw, thanks.
I could second that. I mean, it's a cast full of really energetic, enthusiastic people. And, you know, the Munchkins are as adorable as they should be, probably more. You know, it's every rehearsal is just colorful and fun and... You know, it makes it easy to really be there. Like,
yeah. So are the Munchkins like elementary school kids?
Mostly, yeah. I mean, some of them are a little bit older, but yeah.
And so you are playing Dorothy, and you've got a yellow brick road and an emerald city and the whole thing.
Almost. We're working on it. I mean, this week is tech week. So we'll start seeing all that stuff on stage, and it'll really come to life. So, yeah.
And so, playing the Tin Man, you're really in an ensemble of a couple of people who have to continually be working together, and there's a lot of physical kind of comedy in that.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think the physicality is basically the hardest part of doing the show, because you can never really get into character unless you have a strong idea of who he is. I mean, being a Tin Man, you're basically a robot. But that doesn't mean that you're just a plain old mechanical man. You have feelings, and you need to be more on the human side to get more character.
And so are you wearing a metal suit and everything?
Not exactly metal. I think I'd have to be a bit stronger for that.
Right. Hopefully it looks metal, right?
Yeah.
Right. That is the idea.
Leo makes it look like it is made of metal, though. Good physical actor.
Thanks.
So you are singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow and everything else.
Mm-hmm, yep. And I'd have to say that specific part of the show where I, you know, look off into the distance and sing that song is probably my favorite part. Just, you know, really getting into it and, you know, feeling that's where I really feel Dorothy most. It's just, you know, wanting to get off the farm, wanting to get out of there, you know. Yeah.
And Sophia's an amazing vocalist. Aww. I cry every time, even in rehearsal, just listening to her sing that song.
So how have you, tell us some of the ways, and of course people will see the performance and everything, but how have you made it your own?
Let's see. We've got a couple little tricks up our sleeves, some fun characters that we have added in there that people will see and I'm sure enjoy thoroughly.
Really? You've added some characters that...
Yes, they're I will say no more.
You'll have to come see it.
But they will be fun.
It's not Zozobra.
Zozobra will not be there, unfortunately. Let's see. How have we made this our own? I think that the way that I feel like it is mostly our own is this show is a huge show and it has the potential, I think, to be incredibly stressful to pull together and to feel really like everything has to be literally the way the movie was because it's such a classic. But somehow I've managed to have a lot of fun and sort of take some creative liberties and I don't want to give away the things that are mostly our own. But Yeah, I think that having fun with it has been the way that I've done that for myself.
So you are co-director.
Yes, with Catherine Mark.
Do each of you take a kind of different aspect of the performance?
Yeah, I think that we, for the most part, have the same vision, which is super important. I chose the show last fall. It's the first show that I was in as an actor 12 years ago.
Really? What did you play?
Performing Arts. We added this character named Gloria, which was sort of the guard who sang the Merry Old Land of Oz, who was like the lead beautician to get them ready to go into Oz. And so I thought it would be nice to direct it finally. It's been 12 years since we had done it. Catherine, who started directing with us last summer, wanted to jump on board and be my co-director. Catherine and I have the same vision for the outcome. Catherine's been able to focus a lot on the choreography. We've got a musical director, which is great, Steve Paxton, from the Santa Fe University of Art
awesome
and Design.
Guy.
Yes, indeed.
Really great. And yeah, I like to mostly focus on like the acting values, the emotional connection, and you know, the big picture of it all and how it's all going to come together.
Tell me what you like about the character Dorothy.
Well, to be honest, when I got the part, Dorothy and I did not get along. I thought I had nothing in common with her, and I thought she was really annoying and really whiny. But then, you know, over the course of a bunch of rehearsals, I discovered that I actually had a lot in common with her. And probably my favorite part of her is just how ambitious she is and how set she is on achieving her goals. And, you know, she won't give up at all.
And she's willing to run away.
Yes. And I actually did that a couple times when I was little, so I know what it's like to really want to get away from everything.
How far did you get?
I lived in New Orleans at the time, and I got about 4 blocks away, and I went to our friend's house, and I showed them all the stuff I was bringing with me, and they called my parents, and they said, hey, come get your daughter. So... But yes, we do have a lot in common. It just took me a really long time to figure that out.
What about you, Leo, and the Tin Man?
Well, the Tin Man, I think, he's just a very emotional person, even though he doesn't really think he has feelings, since he doesn't have a heart. But really, you can really connect with him. Pretty much anyone can, because we've all had moments where we want to cry over something that happened to us, or where our feelings just take control of our bodies, and we can't basically take over for a while. And with the Tin Man, he's basically just this vessel for all his emotions to take over. And the only times when he gets to take control back over himself is usually when he's with Dorothy or with his friends. And usually his emotions take control of him to do these really stupid things like getting an axe and chopping off all his body parts without thinking twice. Maybe this is a trick. I mean, really, Dorothy basically gives the Tin Man common sense.
Aww.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, you've got your Scarecrow and Cowardly
yes.
Lion.
Both wonderful actors. Yes.
What school does each one of you go to?
I go to the master's program at the community college.
Oh, okay.
And I'm getting a certificate in creative writing over there.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And you?
I go to Camino de Paz School and Farm down in somewhere in Española, which name escapes me. Santa Cruz. That's it. Santa Cruz.
Okay. And so you are actually doing farming and outdoor stuff as well as your mm-hmm. academics. Very yeah. interesting. So, Megan Burns, you're born and raised here in Santa Fe, I think. Is
mm-hmm.
that right?
Born in Los Alamos, raised in Santa Fe.
And you have been really a very important person in our community arts scene for many years. You've been on the show innumerable times and doing not only Santa Fe performing arts and acting in all kinds of plays and being part of Meow Wolf, but also you are a musician and you're is it a one-man band?
Yes. For the most part, I just released a CD, and that had some other instrumentation on it by some amazing musicians here in town. Matt Sanford, Abe Streep, Johnny Bell. But when I play out, for the most part, yes, me and guitar.
And so your one-man band is called Flamingo Pink.
Yes.
And we're going to hear at the end of the program a little bit of music that you have done.
Yes.
Now, you are moving. You are leaving us.
I am.
You're going to California. I can't believe it.
I know. I'm so excited. Yes. My hope is to book a little music tour, actually, on my way out of town and do a little bit of traveling in June. I'll be here through May. And then, yeah, I'm going to go out to the Bay Area and see what's out there in terms of music and theater and people and friends and all of that. I'm really excited.
Well, it's a tremendous gain for the Bay Area. It's a loss for Santa Fe, but I just wanted to really acknowledge how much you've contributed to this community and to the art scene here and to just so many young people whom you've worked with over the years.
Thank you.
The Wizard of Oz is happening this weekend. Santa Fe Performing Arts and the City Different Players and Teen Ensemble. It's April 19th, 20th, and 21st, and then the following weekend as well, Fridays at 7 o'clock. Fridays and Saturdays at 7 o'clock, and Sundays... No, wait a minute. Fridays... Let me do this again. Fridays at 7 o'clock, and Saturdays and Sundays at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which is a very civilized time. Thank you for doing that.
You're welcome.
At the Armory for the Arts on Old Pecos Trail. The box office number is 984-1370. Megan Burns, Associate Director of Santa Fe Performing Arts. Sophia Avery Kapulski plays Dorothy. Leo O'Connell plays the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our pleasure.
Now to welcome Rick Martinez and Gilda Montaño of Keep Santa Fe Beautiful. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having
thank
us.
You. Same yeah. here. Pleasured.
So you guys are doing things without a whole lot of fanfare that really make this city a better place. And it's ongoing, but there's a couple of major events coming up over the next couple of weeks. For example, this Saturday is... an Earth Day event at the Genoveva Chavez Community Center.
That's correct. We are actually going to be there giving out tree saplings to the first 200 people who come. We purchased some really nice little pine seedlings that we're going to give away. But there's going to be so many other things going on there. It's a great opportunity to pick up a recycling bin. If you don't have one, we'll have those available for you. There'll be somebody there to explain to everybody what's recyclable, what's not, why it's not, and so on and so forth. Lisa Merrill from the Buckman Road Recycling Transfer Station will be there, and she does a great job with all that. But there's going to be body hoops. There's going to be West African dance there. Some other people just giving out information. We have local green and sustainable business expo people there. They're going to have body hoops, which is a hula hoop
like
thing.
Hula hoops, yeah.
Archers de Santa Fe will be there. And all kinds of activities. I mean, there's a lot going on there anyway, but there's going to be even more going on at the Genoveva Chavez Community Center on Saturday. And the event is from 9:30 to 2. And like I said, it's a great event to bring your family out and do some fun stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, whether or not you need a recycling bin or any right. of that, it's just an excuse to go out and have fun and
exactly.
hang out with other members of the community.
Yeah, it will be.
And Saturday's going to be a pretty day. I can already predict it.
Yeah. Yeah, as opposed to all the rain we've been having.
Yeah.
Not.
And then
no wind.
Oh, yeah, well. Then the next Saturday is the April 27th, is the Great American Cleanup Day. What happens on that day?
That's going to be a good day where most of the neighborhoods get together, and we do the cleanups throughout their neighborhoods. And plus we also, Keep Santa Fe People also tries to get people to encourage to clean up around businesses, stuff like that too, just to help do it. And it's registration is over at Siler Road, just off, I guess the address is 1142 Siler Road. And we hand out gloves, hand sanitizers, T-shirts, stuff like that to get you going in the morning. And that really starts about what time do you go?
Our registration starts at 7 a.m. and we're there till 9. This is the opportunity for volunteers and neighborhoods to come and clean up their place. And they need to come and register. The reason for the importance that for registration is so that we know where to pick the trash up after. Because we have two crews, one from Environmental Services Division and one from the Parks Division, who will pick up all the trash that's collected on that
day.
Oh,
the bags.
The bags.
Nice.
Because we do give out bags, too. So we provide you with everything that you'll need to come and clean up the city that day. And then we have crews who pick it up. So it's real important that you come and register your cleanup if you want to go out and do a cleanup. If you don't have someplace that you have in mind, we can send you someplace that, you know, people have called in target areas that are kind of messy and need to be cleaned. We have places like that to send people. So our cleanup is, again, from 7 to 9 a.m. at 1142 Siler Road. You can come and get gloves, bags, T-shirts. We do have hand sanitizer. We have coffee and stuff to get you going in the morning. And then,
so that's when the registration is 7 to 9, and then at 9 o'clock people go all around the city. And if you, for example, if there's a place you say, oh, this little park near my house needs cleaning up, can they call you beforehand or should they just show up at the registration?
They should just show up at the registration and pick up all the stuff that they're going to need to clean up and register that they're going to clean up at this park, and then we can go pick up the bags. The cleanup goes till 12 noon. Our crews will make one last round about 2 o'clock and make sure that they've picked up every place that's been registered. And at 12, we host a picnic for all of our volunteers. And we have some great businesses from all over Santa Fe who donate food for all of them. It's a great event. We have a lot of fun, and we have door prizes and giveaways. And so
we have kids giveaways and adult giveaways, too.
Yeah, so there's two separate.
Ah, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you guys, Keep Santa Fe Beautiful does all kinds of things throughout the year. I'm sorry we didn't get you on earlier because you just did a big electronic waste pickup.
Yeah, we had a drop-off, actually.
Or drop-off,
It was this past Saturday, again, at our offices on Siler Road.
And that's once a year?
Yes, it's once a year. And we had 204 cars come through the event and drop-off, and we had like 9,000 pounds. I got the email this morning, so I haven't really looked. I just glanced at it, but it was about 9,000 pounds of electronics that we collected.
And that's keeping it out of the landfill, which is the best thing.
Very important to do, because a lot of the material in there is recyclable if you recycle it, and if you don't, it's kind of toxic.
It is, exactly. And that's one of the goals that keeps that very beautiful, is to not only look at the garbage, but to look at what recycling we can throughout the city.
Yeah, and keep it from being illegally dumped.
Exactly. Gilda Montaño and Rick Martinez are from Keep Santa Fe Beautiful. And once again, next Saturday, the 27th of April, people can go to Siler Road. What's the number again on Siler Road?
It's 1142 Siler Road.
1142 Siler Road, and register for the Great American Cleanup. Meanwhile, this Saturday, the Earth Day event, all morning and early afternoon at the Genoveva Chavez Community Center. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. If anybody has more questions, they can call 955-2215 or go to keepsantafebeautiful.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks. Pleasure.